Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but don't you know we're gonna have a solar.
All right, don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia? That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, along with the Rivertown Kids, in their Grammy-winning album from Appleseed Records, Tomorrow's Children. This is Harvey Wasserman. We've got another hour for you here at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Richard Charnin is joining us. Richard, a great expert on stolen elections. We're also going to be joined, hopefully, by Bob Fitrakis, my co-conspirator of many, many years. Should be joining us momentarily here from Columbus, Ohio, where I'm talking to you from. Richard, yeah, you're with us. You're successfully hooked up.
Yes, I am.
Very good. Where are you, Richard?
I'm down here in Delray Beach, Florida.
Oh, my God. Must be hot down there.
No, not really. It's not too bad.
Good, good, good. Well, listen, before we get into stolen elections, at the half hour, by the way, at 2:30 or so, we will be joined by Matt Rothschild, the longtime editor of the Progressive magazine, who is going to talk to us about Wisconsin and what happened there. He's in Madison, and will give us a ground-level look, but I wanted to start, as I always do, talking about the latest developments with nuclear power. Richard, if you'll hang with us.
Sure.
Atomic energy is on the ropes worldwide, thankfully, but also causing us tremendous problems. I have posted a piece today at, well, it's been up for a couple of days, at freepress.org. And we're joined by the publisher of freepress.org, Bob Fitrakis. Bob, you there? Bob Fitrakis? Okay, well.
Hello, Harvey.
Yeah, Bob. Okay, how are you? Okay, listen, I'm talking about the Free Press. I have a piece up at freepress.org called Hold That Hot Fukushima Sushi. It's about the fact that tuna has been found off the coast of California, which is radioactive. We've been talking about that on the show for a couple of weeks. Yesterday, we put out a mass mailing from the new from the website I edit called nukefree.org, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E.org. I urge everyone to go there. I asked, we had an email collectively sent by Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Brown, and Graham Nash asking people to sign on our petition to kill the loan guarantees, $8.33 billion worth, proposed to fund the Vogtle reactors in Georgia. We have learned, actually, much to our happy surprise, that these loan guarantees are not a done deal, that there's still quite a bit of wrangling going on between the Department of Energy, the Office of Management and Budget, and the Southern Company, which is building these ridiculous reactors in Georgia. And so it's not a done deal. And yesterday, my good buddy Trevor, the programmer at nukefree.org, sent out a mass mailing and to asking people to sign our petition through the nukefree.org website. And to date, well over 800 people have jumped in and signed this petition, new people. It takes our total close to 3,000, and we're going to continue to do that. There are other people, Nuclear Information Resource Service at NARS.org, Beyond Nuclear, and others who are circulating petitions also to stop this, kill this loan guarantee. So join in with us. Go to nukefree.org if you can. sign into the petition. Go to freepress.org and look. We are desperately trying to kill these loan guarantees and prevent new nuclear plants from being built in the United States. The situation at Fukushima is desperate. We have a spent fuel pool 100 feet in the air dangling with tons, literally tons, of the most radioactive substances ever created. God forbid there should be an earthquake there and that stuff come tumbling down. The radiation emissions would be horrific. As it is, many times more radiation was released at Fukushima than was released at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It has come to the United States. There is radioactive debris washing up on the west coast of the United States. It's a horrific situation. Here in the United States, if you look at nukefree.org, there's a number of important developments. It's actually on the front page of the New York Times today. There appears to have been a major breakthrough in battery technology, which will really speed up the solartopian revolution in green energy, especially in wind and solar. And there are also significant indications that in France, with a new socialist parliament coming in, that nuclear industry in France, which has been held up as kind of the poster child of the worldwide industry, is going to be not dismantled, but certainly stopped in its tracks. And when that happens, the idea of construction anywhere else in Europe, including Great Britain, is probably going to stop. So we've also had indication that there's a serious debate going on in China about whether or not to build new nuclear plants, and that's really the game over for both the nuclear power industry and the planet. The Chinese have been talking about building 30 new reactors, more than 30 actually. That's been put on hold since Fukushima. And indicators are it's still on hold, that there's still a fierce debate going on in China. A lot of the radiation from Fukushima came directly into China, of course. And so far, there's no clear decision on where they're going to move ahead. The Prime Minister of Japan is trying to force open a couple of reactors in Japan. And according to the New York Times, 66%, two-thirds of the people of Japan, are opposed to any of the 50 still operable reactors in Japan from reopening. So that's going to be a very interesting dynamic. And that's the report from Lake Wobegon and the nuclear power industry. Bob Fitrakis, you and I have been co-conspirators for more than 20 years. We witnessed in 2004 the theft of a presidential election. And you and Richard Charnin have continued to focus. You and I, of course, are writing a book about this now, which we hope to have out soon. Can you tell us what are the prospects? And Richard, join in once Bob has said his piece here, please. What are the prospects of the GOP, the grand old Republican Party, stealing the 2012 election?
Well, if you mean the 2012 presidential election,
we can talk about the senatorial congressional races too. But let's start with the presidential.
Well, the presidential race would be easy to steal. The Republican strategy is really it does two things, Harvey, as you well know. It shrinks the electorate through massive purges, which makes no sense in an era of computers. They've already purged more than 1 million voters in Ohio. There's been mass purges in Florida as well. There's only a handful of states, a dozen or so competitive states, the battleground states. So what they do is they move in using every aspect of the law and also doing illegal things. And they challenge people, so they shrink the electorate so that the race can be within, 5-10% of the vote. And then what they do is their people control the hardware and the software. The people that are the vendors, the people that own the secret proprietary non-transparent codes, are all linked to the Republican Party, the hardware and the software. So what you get with what Richard Charnin's proved mathematically, you get a red shift. More than 5% of the vote has been shifting in relationship to the exit polls. I come out and tell you I voted this way. But the exit polls actually show a consistent, unlikely, impossible, improbable pattern of people shifting to the Republican Party without reporting it. So you're in a situation there where it'll be very, very easy to steal the election.
Richard Charnin, you want to add something into that?
Bob pretty much said it. What I could add is that I agree with everything he said, obviously, and as far as Obama is concerned, recall that he won officially with 53% of the vote. by 9.5 million votes in 2008. The exit polls and my true vote model indicate that he won by 23 million votes. So about
23 million votes?
Yes. Yes.
All right. So tell us what the what's the root of this discrepancy?
Well, the root is massive vote switching on unverifiable computers. I mean, voting machines. I guess that's basically it. There, you know, you have machines which are, and also central processors which tabulate the votes, and nothing was done. It was a landslide, so there was no question of looking into the voting. But again, the unadjusted national exit poll, almost 18,000 respondents, less than 2% margin of error, indicate Obama had 61%, 61-37. The state exit polls, unadjusted, aggregate 83,000 respondents throughout the United States, every state, Obama had 58%. So the final 10 million votes, which came in after Election Day, he had 59% of the votes that came in after Election Day, late votes. Votes that were, let's say, absentee ballots, provisionals, which, of course, are paper ballots. So that pretty much confirms the state and the national unadjusted exit polls, the actual recorded votes that were recorded that were subsequent to Election Day. So the evidence is overwhelming. Yes, he did win by 23 million. I am very confident of that. And that's just, you know, of course, go back to 2004. Kerry won by 10 million.
You're saying John Kerry won in 2004 by 10 million, even though the official tabulated recorded vote count had him losing by what, 2.5, 3 million?
3 million. Yeah, there was a 13 million discrepancy, approximately, just like there was a 13 million discrepancy in margin in 2008. Just to close.
And what is this based on? You're citing exit polls. Who did these exit polls, and why would we think that these exit polls are more credible than the official vote count? Either one of you, Bob, you can take that.
What was that?
I don't think we can have any faith in the official vote count because there's so much documented evidence. That the in Ohio is an example where there were more votes than voters registered. And it's just one particular case because there's been proof, much anecdotal evidence. We know the machines are controlled by right-wing organizations and programmed by right-wing. And there was no way. Let me just try to say it as simply as I can. In 2000, we're told that Gore won by 540,000 popular votes.
You know, Bush won by four.
No, Gore
Bush
actually won the popular
vote. Oh, nationally, yes. In the year 2000, where George W. Bush was officially elected President of the United States, there is no doubt that Al Gore won the national popular vote by more than 500,000. We know that.
Well, no, it's even worse than that. Officially, he won by 540,000 popular. The exit polls show that he won by 5 million. And so does my true vote model. So what do you have here? You have, and then, of course, 2000, you had the Help America Vote Act, brought in all these unverifiable touchscreen machines. Bush knew in 2004 he'd never win the popular or the electoral vote. So there had to be massive fraud. And Kerry, there was a tremendous new Democratic voters. There were 22 million new voters. Kerry had 60%. I can go on and on and on for hours. Kerry won that election in a landslide. The exit polls say that he won with 51-52%. My model says he won with 53%, which when you add in the uncounted ballots and look at total votes cast, Kerry's an 8 to 10 million vote winner. And that just carries through election by election. So Bottom line is Obama at 58 to 60% on a true vote, let's say 58, he had 5% reduction in his vote share due to fraud, so he ended up with 53. Obama is nowhere as popular as he was in 2008, so he needs at least 55% to overcome the fraud, okay, which is built in.
Okay, so, Bob Petraeus, you're a professor of political science at Columbus State Community College. You've been there for quite a while. You and I did co-author four books on election protection and voter theft, including, and we were called the, what were we called, the Woodward and Bernstein of the 2004 election by Reverend Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson said something very important, which I want to cite here on the show. He said, it's one thing to lose an election. It's another thing to lose your democracy. So, Bob, can you tell us how, with all this election fraud, you believe we may be on the brink of losing our democracy?
Well, I mean, if you got to start with the assumption that as long as you allow private companies, private for-profit companies, to secretly maintain your voting system, supply the machines, supply the software, you might as well just go out and hang up neon lights saying steal this election. Without transparency, the U.S. elections do not meet a minimum criteria for democracy. And I say this as the person that co-authored and edited the election report, which was given to the United Nations after the civil war in El Salvador. In El Salvador, we counted the ballots. They were on paper.
What year was this?
This was 1995. I was in El Salvador after the Truth Commission, the UN, came in. The ballots were counted in front of all parties, in front of the media, in front of the international observers and the UN observers. If I would have went into an area and they would have said, hi, we've got a private company doing these on a computer, a far-right company tied to the Arena Party, and no one can see the source code, and they programmed all the machines secretly, I would have simply said, assumption of fraud. The non-transparency creates an assumption of fraud. And what Richard Chernin has shown is now they go out of their way to adjust the polls. But adjusting the polls means merely accepting the vote count on the non-transparent machines controlled by private companies tied to the Republican Party. And people can actually go to an April 11, 2012 article on the Free Press called Will Push and Pray Voting Prevail in 2012? The private companies behind the curtain, the great and powerful advocates of faith-based electronic voting. What you'll find is that the companies like Smart Tech, like Triad, like New Media, where Mike Connell ended up dead when he was trying to testify on this issue before Congress. All of these have ties not only to the Republican Party, but are very much involved in the hardcore right-to-life movement, and in many cases would have no trouble doing what they see as God's will and stopping the unborn baby Holocaust over, letting man's vote prevail. These are very hardcore right-to-life, hardcore Republican people who are programming and own these machines.
Better? Okay, okay.
All right.
So Bob Petraeus.
Yes.
You're telling us that the fix is in, and Richard Chernin, the fix is in on the American electoral process. Are you? Of course, we all know that. Given the chance to do it, the Republicans would never steal an election. They're much too religiously pure for that. But let's put it this way. Let's say there's a close race between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama come November, and the Republicans call Rove, who is not a religious man, decides he wants to make sure that Mitt Romney gets in the White House, even though he knows that Barack Obama has won the popular vote. How's he going to do it? What steps will he take to steal this election?
Well, he could shift a lot of things. He could go to the central tabulators. They could do, in Ohio, what they've done in the past. They send in technicians to the Board of Elections. Triad went around in 44 counties with patches, software updates just prior to the election. In almost every county where there was a suspect vote, a technician shows in, shows up, they're unchallenged, they go in, and they fix with a patch the software problems, which could easily allow the rigging of the election. You can simply preset the result. Whatever you program into a computer, you get out of a computer. The only people I've never had to convince were computer programmers.
Okay, Richard Charnham, what do you got to say to that?
Once again, I agree, and I've been programming for 45 years or more, and I am not an expert on communication software, but I've done a lot of programming. I will say this, that Steve Spoonamore is an expert on communications software, security of computer systems. And there's terrific videos where he is interviewed, and he can explain, well, of course, he also knows very much what Bob was talking about as far as the Ohio 2004 election.
Let's go, Richard Turner. We have and Bob will take us, we have a caller, John, in California. You want to talk about electronic voting machines? Let's hear it.
Yeah, can you guys hear me?
Yes, you're good.
Mm-hmm.
This issue of the electronic voting machines has been very near and dear to me, and it goes all the way back to 2002 with the Help America Vote Act, when the Congress flooded the country with $3.5 billion worth of these machines. And your guests have commented, in essence, if we don't have transparent elections, we don't have a free society. And so what this comes down then is the question of, well, what are we going to do about it? We've been talking about this for literally a decade now, about the non-transparency in our elections. And what I would hope that you guys would do with your show is have a couple folks on or do a segment in the near future about the Article 5 Convention. Now, this is a feature of our Constitution where the people from the states can come together in a non-binding deliberative assembly and propose amendments that Congress never will. And when you look at the electoral reform in America today, it's quite obvious that we need a federal standard for voting and voter registration. By creating a federal standard, we would reduce all these points of failure, we would increase accuracy, and the will of the people would be accurately expressed. So I really hope you guys can have a show on the Article 5 Convention soon. There's a national group out there, Friends of the Article 5 Convention, and they have some scholars and a former Chief Justice from Michigan who are, and a growing number of folks now from both the right and the left are saying, hey, it's time for us to dust off the Constitution, hold a convention, propose some ideas Congress never will, so we can get things back on track.
Well, let's talk about Section 5 right now. I'm on with Bob Fitrakis and Richard Charnin, experts on voter theft and voter fraud and how to protect elections. We're going to talk also about registration in a few minutes after the break, and how the Republicans have been stripping the voter rolls and may already have stripped another people to enough potential Democratic voters to win the 2012 election. But, Bob, what do you got to say about what our caller has just said, John from California?
Oh, I think it's a great idea, and we recall that it was the Libertarians and Green parties that actually challenged the election in Ohio in 2004, not John Kerry and the Democrats. There seems to be some agreement, almost a gentleman's handicap, that the Republicans get a 5% shift in their direction, and they're allowed to purge any poor people, elderly, students, and black people in urban areas that they want to. So I think there needs to be, and one of the proposals, we really need to have a universal voting right. Not only do we need to vote on paper and have transparency, but, you know, why are we out there purging people, Harvey, in a computer era? You get, you know, in Cleveland, 167,000 people get these letters in the mail from the Republican Party or the Board of Elections, and if you don't respond to them, they throw you off the voting rolls. I mean, they don't keep you on and put an asterisk by it and say, ask them to identify. They literally take away your voting right. And no other democracy in the European Union does that, because voting is a universal right.
Well, Dr. Chakas, publisher of the Columbus Free Press, professor of political science at Columbus State Community College, you and I actually helped break the stories about the Diebold voting machines. What is the status of these voting machines since 2000? Have they spread? Are there more? Are there less? What's the deal?
Well, the Triad, which was the technical company, has gone from 44 counties to, last we looked, 57 counties.
Well, this
so
is in Ohio.
Partisan, yeah, technicians. Diebold and ESS, you know, Diebold was exposed by us and others and ended up changing its name to Premier, but then merging with ESS, which means now they control about 80% of the voting machines. The other thing we exposed at the Free Press was the outsourcing of votes in 2004 to Smart Tech in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where the real-time counting of votes occurred at a private company without the state of Ohio involved. And now a lot of that vote counting's actually been outsourced to a private company in Spain. I mean, it's
what?
Absurd.
So you're saying that the votes in a
A lot of the processing will now be done overseas. Bev Harris did a good job of reporting on this, on black box voting. They have
Let me ask you a question here. I vote in Columbus, Ohio.
Right.
So if I cast the vote, I have to, unfortunately, my local precinct has a voting machine, but I have, I now vote absentee. And you don't have to be out of town anymore to vote absentee. So I get a paper ballot, and I mail it in. Is that vote going to be shipped over to Spain to be counted?
Not yours, but the ones on election. I mean, some of the initial reporting will be of your ballot, but those will be counted here locally. The tabulation reporting could easily be done in Spain. In 2004, in the
why
wee hours
Spain?
Of...
Did Karl Rove have a villa in Spain? I mean, why Spain?
I don't know. Probably cheaper. They're outsourcing like wind turbines. But remember, they in 2004 in Ohio, and there's an article people can go to the Free Press and put new filings. These are court records where the papers were filed. The other side admitted that the vote count in Ohio stopped, supposedly, a denial of service attack at the Secretary of State's office. So they outsourced the vote count to Chattanooga, Tennessee, to one of the most notorious Republican private companies in America, Smart Tech, the same place where the White House had its websites and the people attacking John Kerry, the Swift Voters for Truth. All the Republican sites were there with the vote count from Ohio. And it's only after it shifted down to Chattanooga, Tennessee, was there some startling turnaround for George W. Bush, which Richard Charnin, you know, is able to show that didn't happen in reality. But yes,
well,
I mean,
okay.
What they do is we have these sites where we can actually tabulate the votes in Spain anywhere on earth, really, and bring them back to the United States.
All right, we're talking with Bob Chakas and Richard Charnin. After the break, we'll be joined hopefully by Matt Rothschild in Madison, Wisconsin, to talk about the recall election there. We will be back after a short break hearing Dana Lyon sing a Rock the Coppers. Oh, no, I guess we got Pete Seeger.
Will we bit the apple and the garden was...
Clean air, water, rooftop gardens, title deal, thermal power, family, community, healthy children.
All right, we are back again with the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. That was the great Dana Lyons of Casual Guns fame, singing the Solartopia Rocky Top version. We're joined now. We've been talking about election theft with Al Buff, Trakas, and Richard Chernin. Bob and I have co-authored four books on election theft, and we are going to finish the show talking about the prospects for the theft of the 2012 election. But in the meantime, we have a truly great Matt Rothschild with us. Matt's the editor of the Progressive magazine. His show, whether he knows it or not, airs at the Progressive Radio Network at 11 a.m. on Tuesday. That's Eastern Time. Matt, you with us?
I'm with you, Harvey. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. And listen, I read your piece at Common Dreams about what happened in Wisconsin. You are talking to us from Madison. By the way, you are the third editor of the Progressive that I have worked with. I actually had my first piece ever published in a major magazine by Morris Rubin back in 1968, and then I worked for many years with Irwin Hall. When did you become editor of the Progressive?
In 1994. So you are one of our longest writers, longest ongoing writers in the Progressive.
That's right. I'm in the geriatric section of the Progressive magazine. So, Matt, tell us what happened in Wisconsin and what can we expect in the fall?
Well, it was a brutal defeat here, no matter how Walker won. And the thing that shocked me was that he didn't get that Tom Barrett, his challenger, didn't get more of the labor vote. He only got, according to the exit polls anyway, 38% of union households actually voted for Scott Walker, the guy who had his boot on their throat. And that's a real problem. That means if those figures are accurate, that the unions weren't getting their own message to their own members. And
what would make you think the numbers aren't accurate?
Well, I mean, I've been reading some of the stuff that Bob's been doing and Richard's been doing, so who knows? I think the exit polls probably, I think that's all we got to go on now as far as this union household thing as opposed to the actual votes or the so-called actual votes. So, you know, I'm just trying to interpret what happened from the data that I have, and I also did some reporting outside of Madison, which convinced me that, you know, the union message wasn't getting all the way down, because I talked to a nurse, for instance, who is married to a union electrician, and they were both voting for Walker, and I asked them why, and they said because they don't want to be saddle their children with a lot of debt. Well, you know, you've got to balance the budget, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, here in Wisconsin and in most states, so it's not like they were going to be saddled with more debt, whether Tom Barrett was governor or Scott Walker. So the message got through, the Walker message got through, and the Tom Barrett message obviously didn't get through. So this was very frustrating. And to me, the bigger question, other than this election, was the strategic move, the strategic decision made early on by the state Democratic Party and by the heads of the state AFL to funnel all this great mass mobilization energy into the very narrow and murky channels of the Democratic Party in the recall process. We had 100,000 people here and then 120,000 people here on subsequent weekends around the Capitol. And there was a lot of power right there present in those numbers. And I think the size of the protest surprised and actually scared the AFL-CIO and actually scared the head of the Democratic Party, because they couldn't control it. People were all of a sudden talking about a general strike. Oh, my God, a general strike. And they didn't want any part of it. And so as soon as they could, they dismissed the crowds and told everyone to go back home.
What also amazed me was that people worked so hard to get a recall vote, and then the guy who ran, that they ran against Scott Walker, was the same guy he beat to get in the first place.
Well, there was a real problem in that there was no great candidate. I mean, Russ Feingold had taken himself out early, because he was burned out after being in the Senate, and then there was no obvious other candidate. And it was just kind of crazy. I talked to the state legislator the day after the election, and she said Tom Barrett was our sacrificial lamb. Well, by all means, why in the world did they go for the recall if they didn't have anyone who knew how to fly the recall plane, you know? It was just ridiculous.
So this is another breakdown, another failure, another sellout from the Democratic Party?
Well, I think the real problem was the Democratic Party. Well, it was a sellout by the White House, for sure. It was a sellout.
Tell us about the White House. Well, we'll finish with the Democratic Party, and then let's talk about the White House here.
Okay, so, I mean, we can talk about the national Democratic. Here, locally, though, I think there was a strategic blunder not engaging those 100,000 people in some acts of creative nonviolence, of civil disobedience. That's what Martin Luther King Jr. would have done. And there was no effort to, for instance, do creative disturbances in the workplace after that first week when the teachers walked out illegally. I mean, the Teamsters could have driven three abreast up and down the interstate for a day or two to tell people what kind of strength we had. And there could have been kind of a rolling blue flu epidemic in one profession after another, in one shop after another, where people called in sick, or people could just do the bare minimum, the so-called work-to-rule strategy that unions and union organizers have used for generations. And yet none of that was enacted, much less contemplated, I don't think.
Well, so you're talking about real power versus electoral power.
Right.
Let's talk
about
the White
House.
I'm
talking about the power of masses of people. And the amazing thing about last February and March in Madison was we had solidarity, real solidarity. It wasn't a hackneyed folk song. It wasn't a cliched farewell on an email to a fellow activist. This was real solidarity. We had people from every profession here, in every age and every color. All of a sudden marching together, and people's consciousness was being raised every minute out there. People were saying, you know, I've voted Republican my whole life, not going to do that again. Or I've been in a union for 20 years, I didn't really know what it was about, now I know what it's about. All sorts of eyes were being opened. And then, you know, when we all went home to do these little recalls, the energy was diffused and our power was evaporating.
So you're saying basically the electoral process and the recall just was a dead end that really diverted everybody from real social change.
Well, I don't think it was an either or. I think they could have done the recall, especially of Walker, because people would have wanted the Walker recall ultimately. But the idea of not even entertaining the other options that were available and just basically selling out the idea that anything but electoral in the Democratic Party action is useless. I mean, I think that really gave people the wrong lesson out of this whole thing. And people were understanding the lesson when they were in the streets. They felt the power.
And how much better would Tom Barrett have been than Scott Walker?
Well, Tom Barrett would have been a lot better, but he's, you know, your kind of house and garden variety Democrat. I mean, he's not, you know, the ultimate progressive. He is a decent human being, which our current governor is not, and he has some appreciation for collective bargaining, which the current governor doesn't have any, and he respects the environment to some extent, and Walker's whole emblem and slogan is open for business. Everything's open for business. That's what he said the first time he was elected. That was the slogan he ran on.
Okay, now just to make sure we get a little balance, the Democrats in this recall election did somehow retake control of the Wisconsin Senate. Is that true?
Yes, they won the one state Senate seat, but I don't get a lot of solace out of that, and I'm frustrated, almost angry at people who are sugarcoating it, because ultimately it's not going to make much difference. First of all, the legislature isn't in session until after the next election in November, and after the next election, the odds are overwhelming that the Republicans are going to regain the state Senate, and Walker will have some smooth sailing. It was very annoying for me to read, for instance, Richard Trumka, head of the AFL-CIO nationally, saying that this election of the state senator down there in southern Wisconsin showed that we had stopped Scott Walker dead in his tracks. I mean, nothing could be further from the truth than that. So why kid people? I mean, they treat us like we're little kids here who have an owie and need a piece of candy or something.
Okay, now let's talk about the White House. What was the role, what should the White House have done, and what did it do in this recall election?
Well, Harvey, this was just outrageous, and I'm still fuming about it. Barack Obama, bad enough that he and Joe Biden didn't come out here in March or February of 2011 when we were, you know, rallying with 100,000 people in the cold and the snow. But even worse, Biden didn't show up in the last 6 weeks when it was crucial to get some support from the White House and the Democratic National Committee. He, you know, couldn't find Wisconsin with a flashlight and GPS. Obama couldn't. Hell, he was at Minneapolis on Friday before the election. All he had to do was drive the White House limo, you know, 20 miles across the Mississippi River and hold up the arm of Tom Barrett and say, this is a decent guy. All decent people in Wisconsin should go vote for him. I mean, he couldn't bother to do that. Actually, he literally mailed it in. He tweeted 12 hours before the election saying, go vote for Tom Barrett. I mean, that was insulting.
Are you sure that wasn't Sarah Palin who did that?
Could have been. I mean, this whole thing. And then they had the chutzpah 2 days later to send out an email condescendingly congratulating us for all our hard work in the Tom Barrett campaign. And then the very next day, another email saying, please give money to Obama for president. Man, I bet they got a lot of nasty responses to that one.
Well, I hope so. Is there any indication that the vote count was not, I mean, you were saying it sort of at the top, that there wasn't things that weren't particularly kosher about the vote count in the in this
Well,
recall.
I've been reading your stuff, and,
yeah,
you know.
That's a hell of a question for me to ask.
And the amazing thing, that there was a weird thing to me, you know, where I was Tuesday night, I was in the local CBS affiliate, TV affiliate, doing a commentary, and the first information that came across was a CNN exit poll that said it's too close to call. And then, you know, by 9 o'clock here, or even before nine, without an hour elapsed after the polls had closed, with people still in line in Milwaukee ready to vote, they called the election. I mean, the networks called the election. You know, we were very late and reluctant to call the election in our little studio. But God, it was amazing. And so that struck me as odd and certainly poor form at a very minimum.
Bob Patricus, does that sound familiar?
Yeah, it's the same pattern. The problem is that the exit polls are actually the international gold standard. It's what our U.S. State Department indicates. And what's been happening is, I mean, we used to admit to rigging elections in the third world. The CIA used to call that benign operations. And a lot of this, people don't want to look at in detail, but really came in with the Bush family. If you look at suddenly the laws of universal statistics not applying in election, and now we have, and Chernin's been able to show this directly, what's called a red shift. It seems that the problem is that it's also one-sided, and it's in these battleground states. So, everyone was saying it was neck and neck. And the other thing they do is they adjust the exit polls, which goes against social science. In social science, you're supposed to go through this long list, which is often known as his mystery. You're supposed to look at for some historical explanation, and then you're supposed to go to the instrumentation. That is the machines themselves. We know from the Election Assistance Commission of the federal government that in Cleveland last year in the elections is that there was a vote shift of more than 10% in the OptiScan machines used in Cleveland. So whenever they find these malfunctionings of the machines, they say it's an isolated incident. Nobody wants
Matt,
to think.
Did you have any reports of malfunctioning voting machines in Wisconsin?
I can't say for sure on that. I thought I saw something on it, but I can't bring it up in my mind or on my computer. But, you know, I've been following what Bob's been doing, and it is intriguing to me and distressing in that we don't have these paper ballots to recount here or hand recounting in Wisconsin. There was hand recounting, I believe, at the state Supreme Court race that was so very close last time around, and there was some question of whether a county clerk in a very Republican county was doctoring the vote tallies there, too.
Bob, did you look at anything in Wisconsin that would indicate there were specific problems with this recall vote?
Well, Richard wrote about it. The problem is that it's falling outside the natural margin of error. And, again, when it does it over and over and over again, it would indicate either some fundamental flaw in the design of the exit polls, or that somebody can tamper with the vote to produce this 5% red shift. And I don't think they'd be willing to do it if they weren't so successful at shrinking the electorate. And you've got the same things in Wisconsin we had in Ohio in 2004. You know, the election's not on this day, or if you sign the petition, you don't have to go out and vote. And there was mention of a force of people coming up from Texas. In 2004, we had the mighty Texas Strike Force going all over the state of Ohio, committing what I believe to be illegal acts, calling people.
Well, they were intimidating. They were intimidating voters. They're getting
sure, absolutely closing
let's
polls.
Let's expand this real quick. We only have 10 minutes left. Matt, you're welcome to stay on. Matt Rothschild, editor of the Progressive Magazine, Rob Strakis, publisher of the Columbus Free Press, and www.freepress.org, Richard Charnin, election protection expert. What are the odds, and Bob, we'll start with you, that the Republican Party, if somehow, and after Wisconsin, I can't imagine it, but if somehow Barack Obama would really win the 2012 election in the popular vote, what are the odds that Mitt Romney, Karl Rove, and the Republicans could steal it through a number of ways? And tell us, Bob, quickly also, how many people have actually been disenfranchised already leading into the 2012 vote? Because this is a huge story.
Well, you know, here in Ohio, they've purged more than the million. The problem is that...
Wait. They've purged, Ohio in 2004, as I recall, had 5.4 million voters. And you're saying that a million have now been purged from the voter rolls in Ohio?
Well, actually, it's gone up. In 2004, from the 2004 election, they purged 305,000 voters in Ohio. But they were all from three areas, Cincinnati, Cleveland,
and Columbus.
Toledo. Columbus didn't actually purge, but they purged in 2008, massive purges. They purged about 1.25 million, about a million of them still eligible to vote.
These are primarily in Democratic areas.
I'll give you an example. They purged 24.93% of the voters in Cleveland between the 2000 election and 2004. Also, a lot of the rural counties, and I've named them in my article, like Hancock and other rural counties, actually Miami County famously in 2004 didn't purge anyone. So the rural Republican counties have these inflated voter rolls while all the purges are occurring in the major urban areas. And partly the problem in Cuyahoga County is the white Democrats that control the county government, which is often involved in corruption scandal, often teams with the Republican Party to purge the black voters and Latino voters of Cleveland.
Matt, have you noticed any voter purging of the voter rolls in Wisconsin?
I haven't noticed the purging, but what happened here was, first of all, what Bob was talking about, there were allegedly Republican people engaging in voter fraud, calling people up and telling them, if you've signed the petitions, that counts as a vote, so you don't have to go vote. I talked to one guy who got one of those calls. And also, they've made it difficult for students to vote in Wisconsin with a change in the voting laws that Walker rammed through that requires people to demonstrate at the voting booth that you've been at your residence for the last 28 days. Well, for people who got out of college, you know, on May 20th to come in here and try to vote on June the 5th, that wasn't 28 days, and so they were betwixt and between and were just totally befuddled as to where they could vote. That caused a great deal of confusion, and we posted something on that yesterday at our website at progressive.org. So they are disenfranchising people legally, but unconstitutionally here in Wisconsin.
Richard Charnin, are you with us? Okay, Richard has been put on. Richard? Okay,
yeah.
Yeah, Richard, at the top of the show, you gave some pretty strong numbers that you believe were purged from the vote count in 2000, 2004, and 2008. What do you think the odds are that the Republicans could steal the 2012 election?
Well, I can't give you the odds. I mean, I can say that it is a distinct possibility. I mean... As I said, if Obama has less than what I call a true vote is how people really voted. If he has less than 55% of the true vote, then based on the historical numbers, there's a good chance that he's going to get under 50% on the recorded vote. Okay? So, so I would say the chances right now, as I see it, I'd have to lean towards... My gut, and again, this is a gut feel. I can't put any numbers. It's too early. I'm not doing any pre-election polls or anything. But I would say that right now, it looks like Romney has the edge.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna jump way out on a limb here. And Matt Rothschild, editor of the Progressive Magazine. What's the name of your radio show, Matt?
It's just Progressive Radio.
Progressive Radio. And you are on PRN, actually, on Tuesday mornings at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Based on what you said about Barack Obama's total failure to show up, even, in Wisconsin, in what was clearly the most important election of the year, on the recall of Scott Walker. Because, and then what made it so important is we have other governors like Scott Walker. I know it's hard to believe, but we have John Kasich in Ohio, and Rick Scott in Florida, a new guy in Pennsylvania. These Republican governors are just way, way out there. And so the idea of recalling one of them in Wisconsin was critical, and yet the White House did not show up at all, except to send in a tweet. And I'm going to tell you right now, my belief, and Bob Patricus and I have discussed this at great length, is that it was the activist wing of the small D Democratic movement in this country that put Barack Obama in the White House in 2008 by guaranteeing at least a modicum of a fair vote count. And I believe many of the progressives will vote for Obama again in 2012, given a choice between him and Mitt Romney, but they will not come out to work for him. And absent a real activist core coming out to the polls to guarantee a fair vote count, I don't see Barack Obama winning. Bob Patricus, you want to comment on that quickly?
No, I think you're right. And the problem is the organization that re-registered a lot of the votes were the small D Democrats for Barack Obama and ACORN, which is no longer in existence. I'm worried if anyone's really going to re-register, the 250,000 voters purged in the Cleveland area.
Yes, and Matt, you're in a state, Wisconsin, where it's the only swing state where in 2004 the exit polls and the official vote count actually seem to match up. And Kerry won.
Well, it's been very close. The last two presidential races have been real close here, and I'm totally with you, Harvey. I mean, the people who elected Barack Obama were young people in huge numbers, labor, progressives, African-Americans, Latinos. I don't think many of those groups are certainly going to go out and do it. I know young people aren't. Just my daughter knocked on doors. She may not even vote for Obama this time. I mean, there are a lot of young people who just feel he's just another politician after all.
Yes, Bob and Richard Charnin. Richard, can you give us a quick thumbnail sketch? How many people do you, just off the top of your head, have been disenfranchised going into the 2012 election by Republican governors, as in Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania?
No, I really don't know. I know that I'm here in Florida, and I know the governor down here is he's just as bad, if not worse, than Walker. But I can't give you any numbers on that. I will say this. I'd like to say this.
Okay, quickly, because we're almost out of time.
Florida, Ohio, those elections were stolen based on the numbers that I have, based on exit polls and true vote analysis. Those governors shouldn't even be in office.
Okay? The governor shouldn't be in office, either in Ohio or Florida.
Kasich and Scott, both the exit polls show they were defeated easily. So,
okay. Thank you. Thank you for that, Richard Charnin. Matt Rothschild, editor of The Progressive, a quick last word.
Well, just that, we got to go back into the streets. That's the place where social change happens. That's where it was happening in Wisconsin until it got channeled into the Democratic Party.
And Bob Patricus, your last word?
The Black Caucus. Eric Holder knows about the purges in both Florida and now in Ohio. The Black Caucus and Reverend Jesse Jackson has brought it to the attention. So if Obama loses, it'll be because his Justice Department did nothing.
And because he did nothing to bring people out into the streets in his support. Matt Rothschild, editor of the Progressive, Bob Patricus of the Columbus Free Press, Richard Charnin, thank you so much. We'll be back again next week with another thrilling version of the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. I'm Harvey Wasserman.
Over the gas green world, will we multiply? We needed more. The rich got rich, the poor got sore. The fuel ran scarce, the price jumped.